Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon taking your phone calls. If you have questions about the Bible, the Christian faith, or the sanity of the host, feel free to give me a call. The number to join us here is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. We're going to go directly to the phones and talk to Jacob calling from Tacoma, Washington. Hi, Jacob.
Hi, Steve. I think I have a disagreement with you about tithing, but I also have a question about, I'm conflicted about how I should approach this.
Okay.
It is because Matthew 23:23 and Luke 11:42 do not neglect to teach about tithing, but I don't know if it would be within Israel to the Levites, such as individually, or to something like the Levite fund or something. Do you want me to read the verses, and what do you think?
No, I can quote the verses. I know them very well.
Okay.
That's where Jesus rebuked the Pharisees because they paid their tithes of mint, anise, and cumin, but they neglected what Jesus called the weightier matters of the law, which are justice, mercy, and faithfulness, or some translations say faith. And he said, these you ought to have done, meaning the justice, mercy, and faithfulness, the weightier matters, these you ought to have done, and not to leave the other, meaning tithing, undone. So he told the Pharisees that they had been correct in paying tithes, but they had been incorrect in neglecting weightier or more important matters of the law. Now, that doesn't have anything to do with my teaching on tithe. My teaching on tithe is that it's never commanded or even hinted at that Christians should pay tithes. Now, if I were a Pharisee under the Old Covenant, I would expect Jesus to say, yeah, you should be paying your tithes, because that's what the Old Covenant required. You had a temple there. That's what the tithes were for. There was a temple. And the temple staff were the people who were called the Levites. And they were full-time, so they couldn't go out and grow crops and support themselves in other activities. So the people who worshipped at the temple would give a tithe of their income to be the salaries or the support for the Levites who worked full-time at the temple. Now, we don't have any Levites with us today, and we don't have any temple, and therefore there's not a reason in the world to believe we have a tithe, though the Pharisees did. The Pharisees were part of a religion that had a temple and Levites and a law that told them to give 10% to support the Levites. That was, of course, done away in the New Covenant, where we don't have a physical temple. We don't have Levites, and there's no command ever to tithe.
Okay, well, thank you. I was thinking about also the New Covenant in Jeremiah. It talks about God's law, and I think you're saying that's not the law of Moses, but what if it is the law of Moses?
Well, if it is the law of Moses, we're in a lot of trouble, because the law of Moses said we have to make 3 trips a year to Jerusalem to offer animal sacrifices at the festivals. Now, I don't know anyone who does that, because there's no temple there. There's no sacrifices in Jerusalem. So if we are required to keep the law of Moses, then we're all in trouble with God. Right? We're all under the curse, because the law said, cursed is everyone who does not abide in everything that the law teaches. Okay, Paul said if you get circumcised, you're obligated to keep the whole law, 613 laws. You know, if that is true, then we are simply in the wrong religion, because our religion tells us there is no more animal sacrifice. Christ has brought an end to that system. There is no more physical temple. God doesn't dwell in temples made with hands. He dwells in a living temple made of living stones. There is no more priesthood serving God's people. It is the people of God themselves are the priesthood. So, in other words, it's a different religion. Judaism is one religion. Christianity is a different one. And so, if we're supposed to keep the law, we're supposed to be part of the Jewish religion. And Paul said, well, if you do that, you've fallen from grace, and you've become estranged from Christ. So, obviously, you can't be part of two contradictory religions at the same time.
Yeah, I've been telling people that I'm a Christian and that I don't have a religion. So I understand there's Israel and there's the nation. So maybe as a citizen of the United States of America, I'm not required to tithe to Israel.
Well, no one is required to tithe to Israel, because again, there's no Levites there. Even if you lived in Israel, you couldn't give your tithes to the Levites, because they don't exist. And if they did exist, they've got nothing to do because the Levites' job was to take care of the temple, and there's no temple. So it'd be very, very strange if God expected us to keep these laws, and yet he had the temple destroyed 2,000 years before we were born. And, you know, and every generation since then has been unable to keep the law. We could argue that God just wanted to put everyone in a position so he could condemn them for their breaking the law for the past 2,000 years. Or he allowed the temple to be destroyed because the law was passed and fulfilled just like Jesus said it was. That's the view I would take.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you for your answer.
All right, Jacob. Thanks for your call. Benjamin from Ohio, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, brother. I got a question. I'm in 1 Kings, verse 41 to 43 in particular. Speaking of the foreigner who is not of your people, then it goes down to 43. It says, in order that all the people of the earth may know your name and fear you as do the people of Israel. My question one is that referring to even men that, is that showing the openness of the people of Israel, not just being of Jewish descent.
Well, before you clarify your question, you said 1 Kings, and I think you gave some verse numbers, but what chapter were you looking at?
Oh, I'm sorry, 8.
Chapter 8, okay.
I'm sorry about that.
Okay, so Solomon's giving his speech. Okay, so he's giving his speech at the dedication of the temple. So what is it you're asking about it?
Well, I'm asking, like, in 43, I feel like this is saying that he's praying that it's open, that anybody can be part of Israel, almost. That anybody
Absolutely.
Can be part of. Okay, and also, is that similar? I mean, so obviously that's similar to Paul's message.
Well, very much so, yeah. I mean, what is Israel? In the Old Testament, it's the people who keep the covenant that God gave Israel, which was at Mount Sinai, which we were just talking to Jacob about, the old covenant, the law. That was at Mount Sinai. God said, if you keep my covenant, you will be my special people, a holy nation. So not all Jewish people keep the covenant, and some Gentiles do. So the condition for being part of the covenant people is that you keep the covenant. Now, most of the people who came out of Egypt with whom that covenant was made, most of them were Israelites. They were descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But not all of them were, because we're told in Exodus chapter 12 that a mixed multitude went with them, which means people from various races. So there were Gentiles and Jews at Mount Sinai when God made that covenant with them, and he did say to them, if you keep this covenant, you're my people. So that's true in the old covenant. And then Jesus came and made a new covenant with the children of Israel, that is, with the faithful among them, which was the disciples. And then, of course, the faithful remnant of Israel became the church in Jerusalem. Eventually, Gentiles were allowed to come into that, too. So, it's always been the case. God has never accepted somebody because of who their ancestors were. I realize that God did give Israel in the Old Testament some privileges. They didn't have anything to do with their salvation, but gave them some earthly privileges that he didn't give to everybody, and that was because of who their ancestors were. But they wouldn't. But it was made very clear in the Old Testament. There's a remnant within Israel who are faithful, and they are the true Israel that God made promises to. Back when the true Israel, the faithful, were living in the same houses and towns with those who were unfaithful, the unfaithful ones kind of received some of the national benefits that God was putting on the faithful, because it came on them collectively as a society. But also, of course, when the wicked became so wicked that God had to judge the whole society, then unfortunately some of the righteous suffered along with that. So there's two Israels, Paul says in Romans 9:6. He says, not all are Israel who are of Israel. Now, obviously he's not contradicting himself. He's smarter than that. Those who are of Israel refers to, people who are descended from Israel, people who are Jewish. But he said, but not all those are Israel. So there's two Israels. There's an Israel within the Israel. And that the Israel within the Israel is the faithful remnant. And Paul clarifies that just a few verses later, 21 verses later, actually, in verse 27 of Romans 9. He says, he's quoting Isaiah, though the children of Israel be as the sand of the seashore, you know, even though they're a multitude, he said, only the remnant will be saved. So there may be gazillions of children of Israel, but only the remnant of them are the Israel that is saved, that, you know, that the promises apply to.
I appreciate your clarification. This is just me and the Word has given me clarification that has not been taught to me ever.
Yeah, well, I can understand that. We at our website, we have a lot of my lectures, and one of the sets of lectures there is called What Are We to Make of Israel? And in several lectures, I go into this matter very, very much in detail. It's at the Narrow Path. At thenarrowpath.com, if you look under topical lectures, there's a series called What Are We to Make of Israel? That would go into this question more. All right.
I'll check it out, brother. Thank you.
Thank you, Benjamin. Good talking to you. Frank from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, sir. Afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hello. Okay. My question is based on listening to many callers calling into your show before the election, okay, and your response to them. So I would like to ask you specifically, but I hope those same people are hearing, if abortion is so unholy and such a grievous evil, what do you make of Numbers chapter 5, verses 11 through 31?
Numbers chapter 5 has nothing to do with abortion. That's the ritual.
It doesn't?
No. There's no pregnancy involved in it. It's a ritual of jealousy.
It isn't. Well, okay, yeah, fair enough. But I'm saying it doesn't tell the priest how to mix an abortifacient.
Not at all. Do you think that a pregnant woman, if you put dust into a cup of water and she drank it, do you think that's going to abort the baby?
I'm saying that's in the Bible, and it's in regards to infidelity.
Right.
And if there's some doubt of the paternity or whatever,
no, that's not related to paternity.
To
no, there's no paternity even spoken of. There's no pregnancy spoken of. We're talking about a man who suspects his wife has been unfaithful. That's how it starts. Now, a man might suspect his wife is unfaithful even if she's not pregnant. And if she is pregnant, that wouldn't give him any more reason to question if she's been faithful unless he's been abstinent or something. I mean, this is not about a baby. There's no baby in this story. There's a woman, her husband thinks she's been unfaithful. She denies it, but he's not comfortable yet with that. And so God has given a ritual that's tilted in favor of the woman to rid her of her husband's suspicions. And it was that he takes her to the temple, or the tabernacle, and tells what he thinks. He thinks she's been unfaithful. The priest goes and asks her if she has been. She says no. And so he takes some dust from the temple floor. By the way, the cleanest dust anywhere, because people had to wash their feet before they went into the temple. Dust is not perfectly clean, but children eat dust all the time and doesn't bring about any ill effects in many cases. But he takes some dust from the tabernacle floor, puts it in water, and she drinks it. And with the oath that she takes, that if she has been unfaithful to her husband, after she drinks this water, it says her thigh will rot and her belly will swell. Now, there are some people who think that the thigh is a euphemism for her sex organs. There's no real reason to say that that's the case, but some people think that. Let's just realize that that's in the mix, okay? So the woman drinks water. If she is guilty, her belly will swell, and her thigh or her sex organs will rot. Okay, but if she's innocent, nothing will happen. Now, without divine intervention, what will happen every time if the woman drinks water? Have you ever known anyone who got any water in their mouth that had some dirt in it? I don't think I've ever known anyone who drank some dirt in some water, and the result was their thigh or their sex organs rotted and their belly swelled. That would obviously be a supernatural intervention revealing her guilt so that her husband would know the truth. Now, by the way, if she's innocent and God doesn't intervene, which would be most cases, God, I mean, unless God does intervene, there's absolutely nothing going to happen. And she walks out of there, her husband can't suspect her anymore. This has been settled. And so it actually removes the husband's wrongful suspicions about his wife, which is good for her. Good for her to be done with that. It's not fun living in a house where your spouse is wondering if you're cheating all the time. So this is something that vindicates an innocent woman. And the only way that it would have any effect on any woman was if she was guilty and God chose to supernaturally intervene to bring about these strange symptoms. There's no baby involved. There's no abortion. So I'm not really sure where you're getting an abortion in this thing. Can you tell me?
Well, you realize I'm not the only one that's saying this.
I don't care. I read it myself. I don't need anyone to tell me what it
okay.
says. I can read it with my own eyes. Can you read it with
okay.
yours? Okay. Well,
I can. I've read it several times. But
okay, where's the abortion? Where's the abortion?
I'll say it's implied. I'll say it's implied.
Where's the baby?
Again, it's implied because
no,
sexual activity. Well, okay.
Now, listen, I have had many, many decades ago, I had a wife who was unfaithful to me. She didn't get pregnant, but she was unfaithful. I didn't know it until she confessed it to me. It happened more than once. But the truth is that if I had taken her to the tabernacle, I could have found out. But there would be no baby involved. I don't know why you think a baby is involved here. There's not the slightest hint of it.
I already answered you, sir, because it's important.
You answered me by saying you have nothing. So, I'm sorry. You're trying to justify abortion by saying that God caused an abortion? How dare you say that the Bible says God caused an abortion when there's no baby in the passage? There's no abortion. All right? You're accusing God of doing something horrendous, which the Bible doesn't even slightly imply. Okay? Let's talk to Melinda from Redwood Valley, California. Hi, Melinda.
Hi, Steve. I have a question that came up today about the word fatherless in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, I know that God is our father, so that's wonderful. But all of the times in the Bible that it mentions that God is a friend, so to speak, to the fatherless, does that mean just what it sounds like, as in people who didn't grow up with a father? And as someone who didn't grow up with a father, should I go ahead and be comforted and encouraged that this nice thing is mentioned a number of times in the scriptures? And then the second part of the question is, when the Bible does mention the fatherless and the widows, does that also mean just what it says, or is that code for people with unfortunate circumstances in general, and why the emphasis on fatherlessness?
Well, the emphasis on fatherlessness comes from the assumption that every family needed a man to provide and to protect the family. Widows were often victimized by unscrupulous men. And I don't mean they were sexually abused, though they might be. If a woman's got a husband in the house, that's not likely to happen. It might without him, but more in terms of people trying to get their property from them by cheating them out of things and so forth. And the women, the women don't generally in those days. Now, women are different today because they've been brought up differently. But in those days, women didn't go out and publicly confront a man. A man would confront a man. And so a woman who didn't have a man to do that often was, victimized in various ways. And likewise, the child who didn't have a father. Now, if we say, well, why didn't he just say orphans? Why would it be a fatherless? Why not a motherless child? Well, it was assumed that a motherless child still had a father who could protect and support them. A fatherless child, the mother might be having to beg for a living or something like that. And that was often the case if her husband had not left or something. So a widow or an orphan or a fatherless child were simply the kind of people that unscrupulous, criminals or just unscrupulous businessmen might victimize in the courts. They don't have a man to speak for them. And so that's why. I mean, fatherless and widows are often mentioned together in the Old Testament as people who are vulnerable, to being taken advantage of. And so the courts are commanded to make sure that they do justice to the to them. Now, again, one reason the courts have to urge that way is because courts don't always act according to impartial justice. And the Bible itself says that the judges of Israel often were guilty of taking bribes. And again, a widow is more likely to be poor than maybe someone else, a man who's maybe taking her to court to sue her and take her house from her or something like that. And the same man who's got money to sue her for that might also have money to grease the palm of the judge. So a dishonest judge would often rule against the widows and the orphans, not because that was the right thing to do, but because they didn't have the money to bribe the judge. So that's why that's mentioned so often. Now, if you're raised without a father, you're kind of in the same situation as an orphan in that sense. Although in our society, obviously, a woman without a husband is in a much different circumstance because women, generally speaking, can go out and support themselves in our society as readily as a man can. Though it's difficult when you've got children at home. But then it's hard for a man, a single man, to raise, to pay bills when he's got children at home, too. I mean, it's hard for a one-parent household to get by, but it's almost as easy for a woman without a husband to get by today as for a man without a wife to do so if they've got children they're raising. But, yeah, I mean, if insofar as you suffer anything for lack of having had a father in your life, I believe God is saying, that's okay, you got me. You know, I'm a father to the fatherless. So I think there's nothing wrong with you thinking of that verse as applicable to you.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that I was interpreting it right.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Okay, Melinda, thanks for your call. Lori from Minneapolis, Minnesota, welcome.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. I've got a question about the interpretation of John 1, 12 and 13, especially verse 13 about Jesus came to his own and his own did not receive him. And then it says, yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, children born not of natural descent nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. I've always, I understand the born of natural descent meaning just being born human or born through lineage or whatever, but I don't understand that nor of human decision or a husband's will. I don't understand what that means.
Well, it's saying that when people are born naturally, it is born by man's will. That is to say, a man and his wife are doing what they hope will produce a child. Now, in our day, maybe men and women who do those things hope they won't produce a child. But in biblical times, people realize that children are the greatest blessing that can be given to someone by God. And when they didn't have children, or even when they did, they wanted more. And so the idea is that most people in Israel were born because someone wanted them to be born, a man, their father.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And to say they were born of blood means from a bloodline. You know, they're from the bloodline of their father. So now this is not saying that the people being described didn't have this kind of birth, because everybody has. Everybody's born that way. But when he says born not of blood, nor of the will of man, nor the will of flesh, but of God, he means this is what we call a limited negative. A limited negative, these are very commonplace in Scripture, where it says not this, but that. It really means not only this, but that. The context usually makes it clear. Sometimes it's not altogether clear, but most of the time it's very clear that it means not only this, but also that. But it's a figure of speech called a limited negative, and very common in Scripture. This is one of them. It's saying the people I'm talking about, the previous verse says, to those who received him, he gave power to become the children of God.
Right.
Okay. Well, how did they become children of God? Well, in the Old Testament, Isaiah said that Israel was God's child. And in John chapter 8, the Pharisees said to Jesus, we are children of God. And so when it says in John 1:12, you can become a child of God, but not by being a Jew, not by natural birth, not by having the right bloodline, not by having a natural conception. Everybody has had that. He's not arguing that anyone didn't have that. He's saying, but in addition to that, you have to be born of God. So he's saying it's not just natural birth we're talking about here.
Yeah, it was the middle part, that nor of human decision or husband's will. So that phrase, does that, if I'm understanding you correctly, does that mean of a couple wanting to have children?
Right.
Is that what that means?
Right, because of people, well, because of a couple wanting to have sex, yeah.
Okay, because that's the part I never could, I could get. I'd get the rest of it. I was like, well, what do they mean by that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that makes sense now. Thank you so
All
much.
Right. All right, great. Thanks for your call.
Okay.
Well, we are done with the first half hour, but we have another half hour of equal length coming up, and we'll be taking calls through that whole time, too. There are a few lines have opened up if you want to get on those lines, and we'll get to your call in the next half hour. The number to call is 844-484-5737. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. The Narrow Path is not supported by any advertisers, sponsors, sales. We don't sell products. We are sponsored by you. We're listener supported. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or just go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds. Don't go away.
Toward a radically Christian counterculture, as well as hundreds of other stimulating lectures, can be downloaded in MP3 format without charge from the Narrow Path website, www.thenarrowpath.com. There is no charge for anything at the Narrow Path website. Visit us and be amazed at all you've been missing. That web address, www.thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. If you want to call in with your questions about the Bible, the Christian faith, difference of opinion from the host, be glad to talk to you about that. You'll have to call this number right now. We've got some lines open, a very good time for you to call if you want to get through before this half hour is over. Get in now, and we can probably get you in. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Martin from Arizona, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, sir. I just had a question. I believe that there was a rebellion in heaven, and God threw Satan out and a third of the angels with him to earth. He said he threw him down to earth. My question was kind of weird or simple in a way. If a person got in a spaceship and went to another planet or another star system, say, you know, Alpha Centauri, if you could do it, whatever, would that mean that Satan and the angels wouldn't be there, and there'd be less temptations for people, and there'd be actually, there wouldn't be all these wars and murders and killings and diseases and stuff? Would that be possible, or, you know?
Well, the Bible doesn't say. Yeah, the Bible doesn't say that wars come from the devil's activity. It says in James chapter 4, from where do wars and fightings come from among you? He says, do they not come from your lusts that war in your members? He says, you lust and desire to have and cannot obtain. You fight and war, but you have not because you ask not. So he's saying that the reason there are wars is because people crave what other people have. They covet it because of their own desires. He says, it's your own desires that bring this about. Now, it is true that the devil is involved in tempting us, too. The devil appeals to our desires, makes suggestions of evil behavior, which sometimes are intended to appeal to our desires, and he's pretty good at knowing which ones will. And so, you know, the devil's a factor in temptation, but not the only factor. I think that if there was no devil, but we still had our fallen nature, I think we'd still be able to get into a lot of trouble and cause a lot of trouble for other people. I don't know that the Bible really says that the devil's activities are confined to earth. The Bible assumes that man is confined to earth. The Bible says the heavens are the Lord's, but the earth he's given to the sons of men. Will we make it to other star systems? I don't know. Maybe. Maybe we will or maybe we won't. But I guess we'll have to cross that bridge when we come to it, so to speak. If it ever happens, maybe we'll find out whether the devil is in other places, too, besides Earth. There's a good chance he may go wherever people go. I'm not sure. But, we could still get into trouble in our fallen state, even if the devil wasn't there to make things more complicated. Right? Okay. Thank you. Okay, we're going to talk to Parker from Maine. Parker, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I got a question for you. It's kind of a personal one. Can a husband or wife commit sodomy, or I'm confused on that.
Well, I don't. You know, there are various opinions sometimes that Christians have about how much flexibility in sexual activities a couple can have if they're married. Many Christian writers have suggested that, you know, there's nothing particularly forbidden in sexual behavior between a man and a woman. Though I don't know. I just have to ask, what did God make sex for? You know? I think that the idea of doing sexual things that have nothing to do with reproduction is kind of missing the point. Now, I'm not saying you can only in marriage that you can only have sexual relations, you know, if there's a possibility of having a baby that time, because obviously people can get too old to have babies, or one party even in youth might be sterile or barren or whatever. But to engage in sexual activity that is totally unlike anything that God made sex for, to my mind, would be very questionable. I would not feel comfortable with it. I'm not sure why it would be needed. You know, a lot of times people, before they're Christians, they get involved in a lot of kinky kind of sexual things, and then they want to do those things after they get married. Now, I would have to say, what I'd say is, pray about it. Ask God to fill you with the Holy Spirit and to convict you of anything that you're doing that doesn't please Him. That'd be the way to go. And same thing with your wife. To my mind, ordinary, natural sexual behavior is what God designed us for. Now, people can innovate and do all kinds of things that aren't related to what God made it for. And if they're sinning, I don't know. I have to suspect that it's not all that good. But even if it's harmless, what I'm afraid it does is it nurtures in us a dissatisfaction for ordinary sexual activity, which dissatisfaction leads to lots of innovation. And eventually, you know, if you start doing things that aren't natural because they are somehow you get more of a thrill out of it, eventually you won't get more of a thrill. You have to look for something more. You're going to have to look threesomes or something like that. I mean, eventually, it's like a drug. It obviously is a drug. I mean, your hormones are drugs. I mean, they're not drugs, but they're chemicals. And they're consciousness-altering chemicals. So, there is a pleasant usage of those chemicals that God has ordained for a husband and wife. But like other things, if you become addicted to it, then eventually, the ordinary seems blasé, and then you start looking for something different.
Yeah.
And then that different thing eventually is blasé. Then you start looking for weirder and weirder stuff, and that's why our society is where it is. And it only took a generation or two.
Yeah.
We had the sexual revolution in the 60s, which led to, I believe, people being obsessed with sexual activity. And how long did it take? It's been 60 years, I guess. And now in society, they'll do every kinky and weird and corrupt thing. Apparently, that's because they have to do that to get the same kicks that they got, that people usually got from just doing ordinary sexual things. So I don't like to get on that track. I wouldn't want to get on that track. I don't know why anyone would find ordinary sex not pleasant. And now, I will say this. There may be some going to call me or write to me and say, well, we've got a marriage where we can't have vaginal sex because it's, my wife has this or that condition, and it can't, yeah, can't be done. Well, okay, then no doubt other things can substitute for that. But I would say if a couple can engage in ordinary, natural sexual activity, that'd be the thing I'd recommend, because although it may not be outright sin to do some other things, but once you get on that slope, I have to ask why. Are you seeking a degree of pleasure that you don't get anymore out of natural sexual activity? If that's the case, then you're on that slippery slope of addiction, I think, to get which can become very
good. Yeah,
and I don't think any man or woman should do sexually with their partner, with their spouse, anything that the spouse doesn't feel completely in agreement with anyway. But
oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. I also agree. Yeah.
All right, so those are my thoughts.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay, Parker, thanks for your call. God bless.
Yeah, thank you. Bye. God bless.
Okay, we're going to talk to Brant from Mississippi. We still have some lines open if you want to try to jump on the line. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. All right, Brant from Mississippi, welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey. I have a question, because I heard you mention the fallen nature of man.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just explain Romans 7:9?
Romans 7:9? Okay, let me turn there.
Yes, and I happen to be using the English Standard Version, but...
Okay. Yeah, Paul said, Paul said, I was alive once without the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived, and I died. All right, I believe what Paul's saying is that his conscience was clear before he knew the law of God. Now, before he knew the rules. Now, some people never learn the Torah because they don't live somewhere where they hear, you know, the Jewish rules like he did. But, I mean, I think people reach an age where they have a conscience anyway. And, I think all people become aware of God's standards at some level. Obviously, those who have the written scriptures are much more at an advantage because they're more specific. But I think that everybody reaches an age of accountability where they're internally aware that they have done wrong when they've done certain things. That's called the conscience. And when they come to that point, then I believe their conscience scolds them for doing wrong, condemns them for it. Now, Paul said, before I had that kind of knowledge, before I had that consciousness, and he also says elsewhere that it's through the law that he learned that. He got that knowledge through the law. Before he had that, he was alive before God. And I think by that he means not alive in some objective sense, but in a subjective sense. I think his conscience was clear. He was not condemned by his own heart by anything, because even though he may have done things that a person shouldn't do, like all children actually do, he was not really that responsible for it. He didn't know about it. But when you reach an age where you are aware of what's right and wrong, then when the law came, it slew him. He died, he said. Now, died doesn't mean physically died, obviously, but I believe it means that he was condemned. He felt alienated from God by sin and by guilt. That's what I think. Now, die can be used in a number of non-literal ways in the Bible. It can even mean condemned to die. Like Paul says in Romans chapter 8, he said, if Christ is in you, verse 10, the body is dead because of sin, but the spirit is life because of righteousness. Well, my body isn't literally dead, but my body is condemned to die. It will die because of sin. And so sometimes dead means condemned to die, like when Paul said we were dead in trespasses and sins before we knew Christ. Some people would say that's spiritually dead, and that's another interpretation too. The word dead or die can be used a variety of ways, but Paul's saying that his relationship with God was okay before he knew better than to sin. But when the law came, he became aware of his own violations of it, felt condemned, and it slew him spiritually, so to speak.
Okay, well, would you agree that at least the word alive, as used in that verse, is the means the opposite of what died means?
Yes. Yes, being alive is the opposite of being dead. Yeah. So you're kind of hanging out there. Can you give me an idea of where you're going with this? Because I don't mind continuing the conversation, but we don't need long pauses. Go ahead.
Well, the fallen nature of man implies everybody I've ever heard that talked about that believed in total hereditary depravity.
I don't.
You don't.
I don't believe we're born guilty of Adam's sin. I do believe that we're born defenseless against temptation as babies, and we do have desires and lusts, and we as babies we do wrong things. And Jesus said, "Whoever commits sin is a slave of sin." I think the problem is once we reach the age of accountability, the sins we committed before that we weren't held accountable for. But they had an impact on us. If we've gotten in the habit of sinning, it's a slavery. It's a slavery to it. And that's why Paul says that he finds in verse 21 of the same chapter, Romans 7:21, "I find then a law that evil is present with me, the one who wills to be good. For I delight in the law of God according to the inward man, but I see another law in my members warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members." So Paul indicates that, he's got this dynamic of sin that's inherent in him. And that's at war with the law of God, which he approves in his mind. Now, was he born with that? I don't say that he was. He doesn't say that he was. That could be an acquired thing. Like I said, if someone, let's just say a toddler, is becoming selfish and doing selfish and naughty things. Well, I don't think he's accountable for that. I think he's too young to be accountable for that. I don't think God's going to blame him for that until he's old enough to know better. Right, but I do believe that he's still building a pattern in his life. He's building his character. He is he's becoming a sinner by habit, and I think that infects the character and the soul. And I think that, he may not have been born, with some kind of inherited sickness of sin, but whether he was or not, he's got it because he commits sins. And when a person, whoever one yields himself to obey, his slave he is, Paul said in Romans 8, or 6, excuse me.
Yeah, okay. Well, we're basically in agreement.
Okay.
I simply don't use the phrase fallen nature.
Okay.
Because I don't believe an infant is born with fallen nature.
I'm inclined to agree with you. Of course, people would call us Pelagians for that.
I don't like labels. I don't even know what a Pelagian is.
Yeah, I know. People who use the term often don't know what it is either. The truth is that Pelagius didn't teach a lot of the things that people say he did, and he bears the stigma of being called a heretic because Augustine called him a heretic. And in my opinion, Augustine introduced a fair number of heresies himself. So I'm not ashamed of Pelagius. I won't say I'm a Pelagian because I don't know what he taught. I never read him, but there are people who would say that what you and I just said would be Pelagianism. And frankly, they can say whatever they want to, unless they can find that it's unscriptural. I'm unaffected by their disapproval.
Well, I am too. And like I said, we're in agreement, I think.
All right. Well,
that is a tough verse for a Calvinist.
Mm. Oh, yeah. That's true. All right, brother. Well, thank you for your call. We're going to talk next to Oscar from Las Vegas, Nevada. Hi, Oscar. Welcome.
Yes, hi, Steve. My only son, who was 40 years old, passed away a few days ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
He was Catholic by birth, and he believes in God, but he didn't practice his faith as he should have. So 10 days before he passed away, he confessed his sins and received Jesus as his Lord and Savior in his life. So now that he had passed away, can my prayers still help him out to be at peace in the afterlife, or can the intervention or prayers or calling out to the saint like Mother Mary would be of any help?
No, I don't believe so. At least if those things are helpful, the Bible doesn't say so. The Bible doesn't really authorize us to pray to anybody except to God. And I don't think he needs extra prayers. If he gave his life to Christ, if he repented of his sins on his deathbed, then he's with the Lord. Now, you know, the Catholic theology would be that a person like him is now in purgatory because he obviously didn't live for God, and he didn't become much of a saint in his lifetime. But he came to Christ, and therefore he's probably not in hell. I think the Catholic doctor would say he's in purgatory, and that someday he'll get out of there and go to heaven. But the truth is that the Bible doesn't even say there is a purgatory. And if there is, it doesn't say you can do anything about it, like praying for someone to get out. As far as we know, this life is the only thing we're told anything about. We're not given any real information about the next life that would be, you know, that would allow us to be certain of exactly how things look right after someone dies. But if your son, and I'm so sorry for your loss, I have a son the same age approximately, and it'd be a horrible thing to lose a child, but at least in your case, your child did come to Christ, and I believe that, like the thief on the cross, if a person comes to Christ even in their dying day, that they'll be with him in paradise, not in purgatory. Now, I will say this: it's always sad. I mean, if someone repents on their deathbed and they go stand before God, there will be regrets. They'll have regrets that they didn't do that sooner. Like, they'll realize, well, I got one lifetime. And it wasn't even a full life. It was only 41 years in this case. I only got one chance to get it right. And I didn't even do it right until the end. And that's, to my mind, I mean, maybe some people don't think any deeper than that. I'm not sure how anyone could be so shallow a thinker that they think, well, I don't, as long as I go to heaven, I don't care how much of my life I've wasted or how much damage I've done or how much pain I brought to God. You know, to me, I think a thinking person would say, I only get one chance to go through this life. And, you know, it's not just about going to heaven. I want to do the thing that I was made to do. It'd be a shame to get to your end of life and say, well, I never did know what I was supposed to. Or maybe worse, I do now know. And I know I neglected it completely. But I don't think, I mean, probably everybody's going to have regrets of some sort, but that doesn't mean they're not going to be with Christ and happy. And I trust, you know, if your son's choice was sincere to follow Christ at the end, then you can see him when you go to be with him after this.
Well, when you say sincere, Steve, before he passed away, we got to pray together, and there were times that I had him follow what I say to hoping that he would fully accept and strengthen his faith
right.
more.
Well, all so, I can say is he apparently didn't resist that. And
right.
and God knows, you and I don't know, but God knows exactly how deep that was for him. And we can
right.
we can hope for the best. We can hope for the best, and we have reason to. Because you did live to see him turn to Christ.
Yeah.
God bless you, brother.
Thank you very much, Steve. God bless.
Right. Bye now. All right, we're going to talk to April from San Bernardino, California. April, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I'll try and make this quick. My question is about Cain and Abel.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard several pastors mention that Eve might have thought that Cain was the Messiah, the promised Messiah. And if that's the case, that would really, really make a lot of sense as to why Cain became so enraged, because it's like, wait, I'm the I'm the chosen Messiah, and my brother's being accepted and not me. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts on that idea are, and I'll hang up and listen to you on the radio. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your call. The name Cain means acquire. And when he was born, his mother says, I've gotten or acquired a man from the Lord. He was the firstborn. And some people think there's something about her statement that implies that she thought this was going to be the fulfillment of the promise that God made in Genesis chapter 3, where he said that the woman's seed would bruise the serpent's head, which is in verse 15, chapter 3, verse 15, because God said that the woman would have an offspring who would bruise the serpent's head. And so this was her first offspring. She might have thought, well, maybe this was the one, but there's nothing, in my opinion, there's nothing in the Bible that would tell us that she had that particular thought about it. She knew she was going to have lots of kids because God told them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So she knew that this first one was not going to be the only one. So she didn't have any real reason to think this was going to be the specific one that God mentioned. But whether she did or not, I don't think there's enough in her statement to let us know that she thought that way. First of all, she didn't really have any good reason to think that way. But if she did happen to think that, we don't know because her statement does not give that away. At least in my opinion, it does not. All right, let's talk to Glenn from California. We only have a couple minutes, Glenn. Go for it.
Can you explain the ontological argument for the existence of God?
I don't use those kinds of terms. Philosophers do. I'm trying to remember. I think the ontological argument is the idea that where there's design, there's a designer. Now, there's other arguments, too, and I may be getting it mixed up with another one because I never studied philosophy. I just study the Bible and think. I think my own philosophy. But you might know more than I. Am I correct? Is that the argument there's a creation, so there must be a creator?
No, I think it's got to do with the imagination that there's something greater, and if you can't, the greatest thing you can think of has to be God, something along those lines.
I've heard that argument, but I didn't know that. I never heard that called the ontological argument, so I wouldn't associate that with it. But maybe that is part of it. The idea that somebody has said God is that of which nothing greater can be conceived. I forget who said that. I don't know if it was Pascal or somebody like that said that. And that God is that of which nothing greater can be conceived. So just think of the most great thing you can conceive of, and that's God. I don't know that that's a good definition for God. Because what you conceive in your imagination could be wild, could be very different than God. It's true, it won't be any better than God, but you wouldn't necessarily know that. So I'm going to have to say, I don't think that argument really makes the point. Okay, that was Anselm. Anselm's the one who said that. And I guess that is the ontological argument. My wife looked it up for me. And I think you're right, that is the ontological argument. I had heard it expressed differently, but I'd also heard that expression before. That's why I don't like the philosophical names. Let's just talk about the ideas. Anyway, thank you for calling. It's good talking to you and all of you today. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live Monday through Friday for an hour. And we take your calls for an hour every day. We do it for 27, almost 28 years. We stay on the air because we pay for the radio time. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Everything there is free. But you can also donate there if you want at thenarrowpath.com. Have a good weekend. Let's talk again Monday.